Hello and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark Pascal and Francis Schott. Today we have brought back for you yesterday's guest, Blake Spaulding and Jennifer Castle, who wrote a book called With a Measure of Grace and own a restaurant out in Utah called Hell's Backbone Grill. Ladies, welcome to the show.
Hi. Hello.
As we were talking earlier, you don't own just a restaurant in Utah. You own a restaurant in Boulder, Utah, which is a population of 180, while at the same time being the second largest town in Utah. So these guys have opened a restaurant.
Second largest geographically,
obviously. Geographically, yes. So these guys have opened a restaurant out in the backcountry. Would you just tell us a little about where this place is and what it's like out there and why someone would come so far out of their way to go to your place or to go to that place?
Jen, do you want to take this?
Blake.
Okay. Our restaurant is on Scenic Highway 12, right in between Bryce National Park and Capitol Reef National Park. So it's kind of on this loop, this tour of a really beautiful part of the world.
Now, I have a question for you. Aren't they
all
scenic?
In the heart of the Grand Staircase National Monument.
Aren't they all scenic highways out there? We have the New Jersey Turnpike, which is a
non-scenic. This is the only one that's designated in Utah that's designated as an America's most beautiful highway. There's only 12 in the country.
Very nice.
And our restaurant is right off the highway.
Well, now, when you moved out to this place, where did you come from? What is your background beforehand? And how did you meet each other and decide to open a restaurant in the middle of Hell's Backbone Bridge?
In Boulder, Utah.
In Boulder, Utah.
We were both from Flagstaff, Arizona, and we met through the Grand Canyon River community there. I worked as a cook for commercial trips, and Jen worked as a cook for science trips. And that's a nice livelihood in Flagstaff because you spend your time on boats in the bottom of the Grand Canyon and you get paid for it.
And I volunteered, actually.
And so then I had kind of like an extreme catering business where I would do food for documentary film production, cooking for the film crews if they couldn't figure out how to get food to them.
Now you need to
I had my whole, like, on-river kitchen, and I could just pack it up and take it on a plane.
And fly in the sun.
Yeah, I have one of those.
Yeah, you need to talk to us a little bit more about extreme catering.
Yeah,
Because most
really
of us have never heard of that.
Call it.
Well,
Jen and I met through the river community, and then she started working with me doing regular catering and then also some of this extreme catering. And we just realized we were very simpatico, you know, that our value system around food was the same, that we thought the same things tasted nice, that we both didn't like raw onions, and it kind of went on. We both have an obsession with chili.
I think we can sleep at all and still get along. Well, one of the most fascinating things I think that about you guys is where you started and what you've done before this and how it sort of uniquely prepared you to do what you're currently doing. Talk to us about being a river chef, because I read a little bit about, you know, you said, oh, you get to spend your time, so you have a different sensibility than I think I'm lazier than you, and I'm not lazier than many. But you talk about how, you know, you get to spend your time on the river cooking. It doesn't sound like exactly you were sitting on the river drinking martinis. You were working when you catered on the river. What's catering on the river like?
Jen, you talk about that.
Okay, well, first you have a week or a couple of weeks of making lists and making menus, making, you know, a 21-day menu, 3 days a week for 30 hungry trail crew members, in my case, or, you know, 20 fancy diamond-wearing folks in Blake's case. And so you've got a lot of different tastes to feed. You have three meals a day. You've got a couple of snacks. You've got cocktails. And so you have to figure out your amounts, you have to pack them into boxes, you have to pack them onto boats, and then be able to access them, you know, at a moment's notice. So you float and hit a beach, and you can pull out an easy lunch box, but it's still like a full-blown, you know, a couple of choices, a deli spread and taco salad. The dinners are more involved, where you get to the beach, everyone else sets up tents or, you know, goes on a nice hike, and happily, I don't really care about the hiking part, so I would just get to the beach and cook for a couple hours.
So you come down.
Winter, it's hard because the sun goes down at 5. The summer, you've got till 9. But the light is always an issue, the wind, the sand, the people.
Well, and plus, when you cater on a river like this, it says in the boat that you really need to bring everything with you. And
there's no resupply at all.
And including,
no, you're down.
Including the kitchen equipment.
So you're actually doing fine dining menus on the river. I mean, when I go whitewater rafting, we bring sandwiches.
Right. No, we try to make beautiful big dinners. Try to make it fun with Dutch ovens or, you know, some barbecue. But it's definitely.
Well, and you also.
You got to make it nice.
You also write in your book that when you do river catering, that you bring everything with you.
Every
you
grain
have
of
your,
salt
your
that
wash
you need.
Buckets and your.
And you bring everything towels. Away with you, too. All of the waste.
All of it. Yep. You pack it in, you pack it out.
That's kind of gross.
Yeah, well, we have a good system.
You know what? I don't even want to know what it is. Okay, I don't even want to know what your system is. I trust you, and if I ever go river rafting with you, well, we'll find out then.
Yeah, the kitchen boat is usually not the same as the other boat.
Wait, I got it. If we go on one of those trips, it's only going to be a 2-day trip. I'll tell you that right now.
Well,
you would not love it. You would love a long trip.
I'm sure that you're right. Well, we're talking with, just so everyone knows, we're talking with Blake Spaulding and Jennifer Castle, who are the authors of an amazing book called With a Measure of Grace. And With a Measure of Grace is not only a cookbook, it's a book about a restaurant in a very remote place, Boulder, Utah, population 180. And they own Hell's Backbone Grill, which is... I mean, the food that you write about in this book is really marvelous, and what you do out there is also really marvelous, and we'll be talking with them more in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:25. Back with The Restaurant Guys, Mark Pascal and Francis Schott from Stage Left Restaurant in New Brunswick, and we are talking with a couple of other restaurateurs who have just become friends of ours, who own Hell's Backbone Grill in Boulder, Utah, population 180, and they're also the authors of a very fabulous book, which you can find out about more about on our website. It's called With a Measure of Grace, which is both, it's a cookbook, it's a book on restaurants, it's a cook about a small town, it's a book about life, and they're here talking with us today. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, thank you.
You talk about a couple things in moving to this tightly knit Mormon community where you were outsiders and how you've worked your way to be insiders, and how this community sort of tries to protect itself. You mentioned a municipal ordinance that, sure, there can be a drive-through if somebody wants to put a drive-through in there, but no employee can ever wear a uniform at it. I thought that's great.
Well, you keep all the chains out. We know what you're doing.
Yeah. And we didn't establish that. That was That was there before we came along.
That's a mark of great respect for the town. But one of the other things that had never happened is there had never been a liquor license in a restaurant before in that town. And you ladies, with all of your charm, with all your wily ways, went in there and you got yourself a liquor license in Boulder, Utah. How did you do that?
Well that was Blake.
Yeah, it was basically just honesty, and I would call it sort of deep listening.
Mm-hmm.
We went and heard what they had to say about it, and we went very respectfully and said, look, you know, we don't believe that we have the right necessarily to serve alcohol here. It's not like we're stomping our feet about it. But honestly, if you want our restaurant to succeed, we're going to need it because we can't really succeed financially. We won't be able to survive.
It has to be part of the equation.
That's what our customer base really wants, is a glass of wine with their meal. And so we made a commitment to them, you know, with a handshake, basically, that we would never serve hard alcohol, that all we were interested in was beer and wine. And it took a little while, but the town council really, I think, it comes back to good manners and civility, you know, and basically showing up as a good person and asking from your heart for what you need, and they came through for us.
And I have to say, I think it's a lot of credit to the community into which you moved that they looked outside of themselves to something that was not common for them, and they made a real accommodation, and they trusted you. And so I think that was a real symbiotic thing that happened there, and I think that's really beautiful.
Well,
it really has been amazing. And our servers, you know, many of them are LDS or Mormon and have never actually tasted alcohol in their life, but they enjoy serving it, you know, and they have a, you know, what I would say is a healthy respect for the culture and value.
And we're going to talk more about that. And we're going to talk more about that after the news and how you train a server like that. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Hello, everybody. And welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with my partner, Francis Schott. We own Stage Left Restaurant in New Brunswick. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. Listen to us every day from 11 to noon, or you can reach us through restaurantguysradio.com.
We are here talking today with Blake Spaulding and Jennifer Castle, who are the authors of a wonderful, wonderful book called With a Measure of Grace.
Francis has really been talking about this book for the last 2 weeks.
Oh, my God.
Gotta read this book. Gotta read this book. Francis, you have the book. Can you give me the book back? I can't read the book.
We'll send you your own one, Mark.
I can buy my own. We'll be all right.
We could have afforded a second copy. Well, these ladies opened a restaurant in Boulder, Utah, population 180, which is population 180 people, while at the same time the largest town geographically in Utah after Salt Lake City. It's a remote, tiny, tightly knit community, most of whom are Mormon ranchers, one of the country's least accessible towns. So you go there and open up a fine dining restaurant with 30 employees, and you are serving wine, and you pull off the amazing feat of getting a liquor license in this town that's never had one before. And now you have a lot of people who work for you who are LDS or Latter-day Saints or Mormons, and they don't drink alcohol, yet you need to sell wine to stay alive. How does that work?
Well, it actually works really well, and I want to say that initially there were no real employees. Our very first couple of employees were Mormon teenage girls who were wonderful,
uh-huh.
One of whom still comes and works with us periodically.
Mm-hmm.
But now we have about 30, but for years it was like four.
Yeah, we get it. We remember.
So,
Mark, and when we first opened up in 1992, one night Mark was the maitre d' and I was the bartender, and the next night Mark was the bartender and I was the maitre d'. So
Jen and I do a lot of that, too.
Yeah.
We're sort of, it's our very glamorous life of being dishwashers
exactly.
And bus girls.
Dishwashers and garbage men.
Yeah, exactly. Well,
yeah,
it's the restaurant mentality of whatever it takes.
I also have to share, there's a part in the book where you talk about, you know, recycling is so hard to do there, and trash removal out in such a remote place with so few services is so difficult. So you find yourself, you know, looking for diving to the trash bin to find stuff that can go into the compost heap rather than be trekked away. And you think, you know, it keeps you very grounded, but it keeps you from imagining yourselves very glamorous restaurateurs. I remember in July when the sewage ejector pump went down, and I was in there thinking to myself, what am I doing for a living?
Let's talk about something a little more pleasant.
Than the sewage ejector.
Let's move on to perhaps your farm or...
No, we were talking about having employees who don't drink and who yet sell wine. It's an important part of what you do.
Yes, so basically we have wine tastings, and our staff that is, you know, interested in tasting the wine will do so. But then we have taught the LDS Mormon staff to discern the differences between wines by smelling.
Yeah, yeah.
Which, you know, you swirl and you sniff, and you can get so much information from your wine that way. Anyway,
sure.
It really works fine, and they're very curious and interested, and I think they take a certain amount of pride. Particularly, there's a section in the book about Aram and Yosef, the Mormon twins.
Mm-hmm.
They're wonderful guys, and they love to serve wine. Like, they get so excited when someone orders a really expensive bottle of wine.
Well, we teach a consumer wine class. We've been teaching in Jersey for 17 years now. And it grew out of a class to train staffs, and we still use it to train our staff. And we have a number of staff members who work for us who are underage, and we have a number of staff one or two staff members from us at different times who, for one reason or another, didn't drink. It's the same thing. To taste wine like that is, to smell wine like that gives you a lot of what you need to know.
Yeah.
You know, you have a very interesting philosophy in your restaurant. We talk a lot about using local ingredients, and we use local ingredients whenever possible. We buy from family farms whenever possible. You have a very strong philosophy on using only place-based food, stuff that's relevant to where your restaurant is and where it comes from. That's a pretty strict stricture. Has that hit you any with any? That's harder to do, isn't it?
It is. I mean, we make certain accommodations. Of course, we're going to have chocolate, and we're going to have coffee, and we're going to have lemons and limes. But when it comes to things that don't travel well, like fish, we don't serve any seafood in our restaurant. So we do have a local trout that comes from either Utah or Idaho that's a farm-raised red trout that's delicious. It's one of our most popular dishes. But we don't serve any New Zealand green-lipped mussels,
right.
Chilean sea bass,
right.
And these things. And it's something that Jen and I have really gotten a lot of attention for in the media and also with our diners. You know, most of our diners are really get behind it, and they're like eating the local grass-fed beef, fantastic, the local lamb, the greens from the garden, the fruit from the orchards. But we occasionally will have people who come in that are really very sort of put off. They say that our menu is too limited because we don't have seafood. And our kind of mission now is a little bit to oriented towards educating people that fancy or good or fine foods are not necessarily foods that are from somewhere far away. So I really would love to see our dining culture, our population of consumers, move away from the idea that, you know, fancy food is eating Maine lobster on the in San Diego,
yeah,
or eating green lips New Zealand mussels in Taos, New Mexico.
You know, I think that's a movement that is happening even in cities. When you especially here in New York, I mean, there's a whole slew of restaurants. I mean, we have, if you come out here, you have to go to Blue Hill in Greenwich Village or Blue Hill at Stone Barns, which is up in upstate New York, and it's all about buying locally. Now, we're not as strict as you are out there, and we have, you know, being in the greater New York area, we have access to so many things from all over the world. But it's amazing how excited people get. And one of the things we say in this radio show is we have the New Jersey Department of Agriculture come on every week and tell us what's coming up in season.
Oh, wow.
And people are amazed when we come into the restaurant and we say, oh, white peaches are coming in next week, or it's tomato season. And people are, I think, getting that sensibility overall. But you guys really take it to an extreme.
Well, we try to. I mean, we're not like total purists. We do the best we can. But that's definitely the push the direction we're pushing in. We actually have gardeners, full-time gardeners, and they came to me a couple weeks ago and said, with their hands in their hair, saying, you know, you don't need gardeners anymore. You need farmers.
Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit about your garden and what's in your garden. Let's tell us about the types of things you're growing and bringing directly from your backyard, literally, to your table.
Jen, why don't you talk about that?
Well, Blake was just on the cover of Organic Gardening. I think maybe she should handle this one.
Was it a racy picture?
Oh, yeah. I never thought I'd be a cover girl, but it's true. I'm on the cover of the August-September issue of Organic Gardening. And I do work more intensively with the gardens, but then Jen creates the specials.
So what kind of stuff do you seek? What kind of stuff do you seek to plant in your garden?
Well, we grow tons of different kinds of greens, a lot of heirloom vegetables. We are members of Slow Food.
So are we.
And so we are very committed to growing rare and heirloom varieties of vegetables for the purpose of ongoing propagation.
Super duper. We do the same thing.
Wonderful. So we grow beans, pole beans, and bush beans, both heirloom varieties. We grow several varieties of carrots.
Do you find
and
it's
turnips?
Do you find it's more costly to raise your own vegetables than it is to?
Yes.
To buy.
Big hole in the ground where all our money goes.
Yeah.
I mean, it's sort of a sad commentary on the state of our culture that, you know, for us to produce a tomato in our garden is so expensive, and then you can buy one from somewhere far, far away, and it's like nothing.
Well,
but
it's not
really
just
important to taste the food of the place and to grow, you know, to reconnect people with food. I mean, it's pretty funny. We have endless stories about, you know, the kind of funny things that happen with the garden. You know, Jen puts, we have a ton of edible flowers, and we decorate the plates with all these flowers that we grow, and Jen's, you know, favorite thing or not, she has an aversion to earwigs.
Ew.
That's a bug, everybody.
A plate, and all of a sudden an earwig will crawl out of one of the nasturtiums, you know. But we do find it's more expensive, but it's so much more rewarding, and it's really rewarding for our clientele.
But it's not.
I do is wander around the dining room and make everyone eat their vegetables.
That's funny.
I'm sorry, I can't clear that plate until you've eaten $30 green bean.
That's very funny.
It's a $30 green bean.
It's not just more expensive though, and I think that some people just take for granted the expense. It's much more time consuming.
You guys
are investing a lot of time and energy into doing this that most of the restaurateurs are spending doing other things.
By picking up the phone and ordering from Cisco to send them in. But the fact of the matter is that's an investment in quality, and so the consumer needs to be willing to pay more for sustainably grown stuff that's grown locally. And there are a lot of other reasons that local is better, and we'll talk about those in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark Pascal and Francis Schott. Today we're talking with the owner of a delightful restaurant in Boulder, Utah, called Hell's Backbone Grill. And they've written a book called With a Measure of Grace. And they have a delightful little book that I want to read you a quick little excerpt from just to tell you how serious they are about owning this little restaurant. A quote from Blake. The first thing you should understand, Blake likes to tell new employees she's training, is that Hellas is our child, at times a little difficult, slightly neurotic, overdramatic, and spoiled. But we're extremely attached to her and her well-being. The only way it'll work for you to have a job here is if you strive to love her deeply as well. Any indication of neglect or lack of enthusiasm will make it really hard for us to get along. You sound like you're really dedicated to your restaurant.
Well, that's actually verbatim.
Yeah.
I really do say that to people, and Jen has her variation on that as well. I mean, we really, that's how we hire people now. It's really important that they have that they understand that it's beyond restaurant.
Because I'm from New Jersey, I'm going to go to the more negative side of things. You're Buddhist and look at the beginnings of things in life moving forward. I'm going to share with you the beginning of many of our exit interviews. And it goes, and it goes like this. You don't love it here. It's not about me. It's you aren't happy here and you don't love it. Because you know what? If you don't love it, if you're not into it, it's not worth it. It's too many hours. It's nights. You miss holidays. It's really crazy. But if you love being a part of community, bringing people together, feeding people, I mean, that's what food and wine is all about. It's sort of the same impulse you have if you're the kind of person who has an impulse to have a dinner party. People in our industry who really care about it, if it's a great restaurant, I think really take that just to the next level. And you know what? I don't think that's possible. That same sort of passion is possible in a corporate restaurant. Do you, ladies?
No.
Well, you want to be the catalyst of bringing somebody together. I mean, that's the whole idea of a great restaurant.
And if you're doing something completely formulaic that's not creative at all, then how
can you expect somebody to care?
Yeah.
Right. It's just a place to eat.
Exactly. Or a place to get a discount on something. I don't know. But you were talking about how expensive it is to grow your own stuff and how.
But it's so worth it, too.
Yes.
Because, like,
as we get better, it's horrible.
Breck and Becky, our gardeners, brought in, you know, a whole huge basket of all different beets and turnips. And Brian and Stephen, two of our cooks, just went crazy making this beet salad, you know, and turnips and carrots. And it was so delicious. And, you know, Jen will, we get wild foraged baby tumbleweed greens.
And yeah, you don't find that in Jersey a lot.
Anytime we farm.
Jen made these unbelievable tumbleweed and roasted organic chicken enchiladas that, I mean, people were falling on the floor over them. And so it's a lot of work to pay the 12-year-old girls to go forage for the tumbleweed greens, but then the food is so exciting, and Jen gets really excited. She makes such incredible food. She's so gifted.
When we forage here in New Jersey, the neighbor gets really mad that we stole his tomatoes. It's a whole different
thing. And
game.
His dog comes after you. You know, the other thing about local food that a lot of people don't realize, and we go to the green markets to buy from a lot of farmers. We have some farmers that we have relationships with that we deal with directly, and they plant. We get together in the spring and talk about what's going to get planted. Is that when you pick something fresh, which is what, if you have a kitchen garden or you have a plan with a local farmer, if you're buying in a supermarket and you're not buying local and it has to go 10 states to get to you, even to forget from Guatemala, if it even has to go 10 states to get to you, the farmer can't pick ripe fruit because ripe fruit is fragile. Mm-hmm. And ripe fruit is going to be over-the-top fruit in a matter of days. And so if you're buying it in the supermarket and it's not local, it was picked unripe. Okay, and
right. It adds too much risk to them to pick
and
it ripe.
And it will never, you know, putting the peach in the paper bag and putting it on the windowsill is never going to get the flavor that leaving it on the tree until it's ripe and picking it and putting it in your dinner that night is going to get. And so even, you know, you guys said you're members of Slow Food and you use heirloom varieties and special varieties of peaches and pears that are not designed for durability but that are designed for flavor, and we do the same thing. But we find the great advantage is to have stuff picked when it's ripe and served to you that night. And for that, thank heaven, you still need local food.
Absolutely. We have these amazing heirloom varieties. We have a old pioneer orchard that we take care of. And nobody even really knows what these varieties of fruit are, but we've got these summer apples that are on right now that basically are good for 24 hours, and then you have to turn them into apple butter or apple sauce. But they're so special, and we have these tiny wild American plums right now.
Wow.
That are, they're great. Like the size of a grape tomato, and we slice them and put them on the green salad, and it's really exciting. It's fun, and that's basically going back to what I was saying about fish. When when our customers say, but you don't have any seafood, I just say, well,
we don't have any ocean,
but we have these great little plums.
Geography and how old that fish would be, and Ben and I wouldn't feel right serving it to you.
We don't have any seafood because we don't have any ocean, ma'am.
Yes, exactly.
You know, the other thing that I think is people don't realize is that when you are working with nature, it's not always convenient. And if you want to serve local stuff, you guys talk about, and I want to talk about just a little bit when we come back, putting stuff up for the winter and how you have fresh stuff all around, all year round, is, you know, when the peaches come in, the peaches come in. And you better have a bunch of people there ready to put up those peaches or they're gone, or they're gonna go away and rot. Well, you're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hey, you're back with The Restaurant Guys. We are here talking with Blake Spaulding and Jennifer Castle, author of the book With a Measure of Grace, and owners of Hell's Backbone Kitchen in Boulder, Utah, population 180. We were talking about Blake and Jen and how they have their own kitchen garden and get much of their food from their own garden, and how heirloom fruits are so fragile if things are picked locally. You can use varieties of fruit that are somewhat fragile. They're not designed to ship. They're designed to taste good. There's an old adage, you know, Jersey is known for tomatoes and corn. But even in Jersey, a lot of the corn that you get at corn stands is or at farm stands is not the traditional Jersey varieties of corn. They're new super sweet hybrids of corn that taste very sweet, but they sadly don't taste very much like corn, but they're very stable. But in Jersey, we used to have the old adage, we'd say in my family, that if you want to get corn at its best, you put the pot of water on to boil, you then go out into the field and pick the corn and run back to the water to get it going. Do you find that's true with most of your heirloom fruits, that they're much better when you have them that day?
Yes, although we spend a lot of time processing, freezing, preserving, making jam. We make all our own jam for breakfast.
Yeah, but even the jams are better with the fruit that you just pulled off the tree.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Anything, you can't let it sit. So, like, we get sour cherries from Escalante, and they're incredible, and you can't buy sour cherries anywhere anymore.
We spend
3 days pitting cherries with our thumbs.
We have to come to a close relatively soon, but I just want to, one of the most amusing things you've written in your book, which is called, they're owners of Hell's Backbone Grill, and the book is called A Measure of Grace, and the list of rejected book titles you have, which is Blake and Jen Go to Hell Blake and Jen, Hell's Backbone Girls, The Mormon the Merrier, I think all those were, well, wisely rejected, let's just say that.
Yeah,
ladies. Well, listen, we want to thank you for taking the time to talk with us today. I think you guys are really, really great. And how do people get to you if they want to come out and visit you?
Fly into Salt Lake City, rent a car, or Las Vegas. It's actually all the directions are all on our website, which I think will be linked through yours.
How far? Yes, they will. How far are you from Vegas?
About 6 hours, but it's a gorgeous drive, and you go through Zion and Bryce.
So although that seems like a very incongruous trip, Vegas, to you guys.
It's polar opposite.
Well, you can do the Grand Canyon, which is what I think I might do next year. Listen, I want to thank you guys so much for taking the time to talk with us on The Restaurant Guys.
It's been pure pleasure. Thank you.
And it's totally backwards the other way. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450, and the time is 12 noon.